Time for a deep dive into the one issue that matters most in a capitalist democracy, money. This is Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, a joint production of the Maggie Dawn Show and the Patriotic Millionaires. Now, let's start talking money.
Hello, everybody. How y'all doing? Happy Indigenous Peoples Day. Welcome to another episode of Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm very excited to be joined today by Sarah Chase, an author and journalist who's done everything from reporting for National Public Radio in Paris to covering the fall and resurgence of the Taliban in Afghanistan. She served also as a special advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and was a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Sarah is, in a word, an expert on corruption, what it looks like in the modern world, how it's captured in our institutions, and what all of this means for the future. She literally wrote the book on it. It's called On Corruption in America, what is at stake. And that's what we're going to be talking about today, corruption in America, how it's happening, and what that means for you. You ever thought, I hear all these people talking about corruption, but what does that really mean for me? We're going to be talking about it today. Sarah, thank you so much for making time for us here on Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. You've had a long career studying corruption in developing and war-torn countries like Afghanistan. Can we really compare what has happened in those countries to what is going on in America today?
Shockingly, Maggie, yes. Thanks for having me on your show. I'm not one of the millionaires.
Nor am I, my friend.
Yeah, I mean, so I set out, having worked for years in developing countries, Afghanistan, Nigeria, you know, Central Asia, you name it, Nepal. I sensed that the phenomena that I was seeing in countries like that, which do fall into a rough pattern, that pattern was likely to be discernible in the United States. Maggie, I had no idea to what extent. I had no idea how perfectly we map onto the patterns that I was seeing in countries like that. And let me just try to lay out as briefly as I can what I'm talking about. The problem with how we are led to think about corruption most of the time is it's coming to us from either the press or from court cases. And both of those platforms, if you will, they need to have like a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know what I mean? Like there has to be a bad guy who's doing, or him or her and their collection of buddies, who's doing a bad thing, which is kind of has a start and a stop in time. And so that gives us the feeling that these are these one-off events that happen over here, and they happen in Chicago, and they happen in Florida, and it's all scattered. That's not how corruption works. And that's why that way of understanding it is so, I want to say it's deceptive. And it also just makes us turn off, right? Like, oh God, another stupid story, you know. What I found in all of these countries, and first, as you mentioned, in Afghanistan, where I lived and worked for a decade, is that corruption is, in fact, the kind of corruption we have to care about, and the kind of corruption that has taken hold in the United States is the operating system of a sophisticated network or networks. And these networks cross, you know, the boundaries between sectors that we love to keep separate in our minds, right? Like private sector and public sector, right? So our idea is like these are two separate sectors. The genius of kleptocratic or corrupt networks is they've got members in both sides. And in fact, they're often, you know, passing these members around. So they have jobs in business for a while, and then they hold jobs in government, or sometimes both at the same time. And sometimes you've got the out and out criminals, the genuine, you know, drug dealers, weapons traffickers, human traffickers, and stuff like that are wired, violent gangs are wired into these networks. And that is the case as it exists in the United States. And we can talk about details. The details will shift from country to country, depending on what the main sources of revenue streams are. The United States does not have a gigantic source of foreign assistance coming into us, right? So that's not one of the revenue streams that is captured the way it might be in Afghanistan or in, you know, a developing country, Honduras, Guatemala, where I've also worked. What I will say, just to wrap up, is the private sector strands of these networks in every single country that I have studied include finance, defense, high-end real estate, and energy.
Yeah, finance, because you need the banks to launder the money and to facilitate the payments. Real estate, because it's very easy to hide money in incredibly expensive real estate. Energy, because it is needed everywhere. And defense, because every country spends a ton of money on it. And it's this very interwoven intersection of public and private actors within especially these sorts of industries that facilitate this. And it's not, you know, I think one of the things that people mistake is that there needs to be outright law violations, but that's not actually necessary for corruption to take hold, is it?
And here's why, because what do the corrupt do once they're networked? The first thing they start doing is changing the laws to legalize what they're doing. Right. And so that's where you get this huge disconnect between the ordinary population, which can smell corruption a mile away. And I'm not trying to say that everything is corruption. We do have to be a little bit careful. Yes. But this kind of insider capture of political and economic power, that's really what we're getting at here. And the public gets it. The public can see it in every single country I've been to. Again, I mean, but I remember in Uzbekistan, someone telling me the thing is they make it. No, it was in Egypt. Sorry, in Egypt. The genius is they legalize it. And I thought, that's what's happening in the United States.
It's exactly what's happening in the United States. Of course, the Supreme Court declaring that if you bribe a government official, but you just pay him afterwards and you act like it's a tip, maybe not so corrupt. That's corrupt. We know that. The Supreme Court declaring presidents are kings for their official actions. It is opening the door to corruption, something that the minority of justices tried to explicitly point out.
Let me stop you right there. On those two particular ones that you mentioned, the minority was on the right side. But in a whole string of cases leading up to that most recent corruption case, they were all unanimous.
Yeah.
So that's something else we have to be super careful of, is that in fact, up at the top, in both Congress and the Supreme Court, unfortunately, the political divide is not as sharp as it is on cultural issues.
Yes. Well, one of the reasons for that, just from my perspective, Sarah, and I'll gut check it with you, is that judges and justices are what I'm going to call late stage actors. They're getting this after the thing has occurred. They often have only a limited view of facts. They're not seeing all of these cross-sectional interactions. So it's an imperfect solution to look to the legal system for resolve in these matters, though it needs to be part of what is the response. What I wanted to ask you is
can I come in on that one, Maggie?
Of course.
So I think that's brilliant, and I think you're right, and I think there's another piece of this, which is, you know, justices, let's just look at the Supreme Court. So many justices have been involved in the very kinds of taking material benefits in return for access, et cetera. The fact is, this is not, again, it's the judges and even, or justices and even members of Congress, they are judge and party at the same time. We're asking them to make laws and apply laws whose only defendants can be themselves. Ordinary people who don't hold public office are not subject to ethics and corruption laws. And so that's also a systemic issue here.
The self-interest, right? It's quite the quandary, right? Do I want to legislate myself and put lots of restrictions in place? Perhaps not.
Members of these networks. These are the people who are members of the networks, and the networks, among the other sectors that they cross the political divide. And the only hope we have to combat them is if we, the people, can manage to join forces across the political divide. And at the moment, we are at each other's throats, which is exactly where the, you know, nasty millionaires, not the patriotic ones, where they want us.
Yes, because when divided, corruption is given an even larger entree to really take hold, because we're distracted about some potentially very off the point sort of issues, though always important. Folks, my very special guest is Sarah Chase, a world traveled and studied journalist. She's literally written the book on corruption. It's called On Corruption American, What is at Stake? If you do not think corruption impacts you and your life, I'm going to ask Sarah that exact question. My special guest is Sarah Chase, a world-traveled and world-studied journalist and author. She's done everything from reporting for NPR in Paris to covering the fall and resurgence of the Taliban in Afghanistan. She's also served as a special advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. She wrote the book on corruption, literally, folks. The title of that book is On Corruption in America, What is at Stake? We're talking about this now, Sarah, because I think it's so abstract for people. And I think it ends up getting lumped into like, oh, this is just going to happen and they're all rotten. This has a very real impact on people's lives. And we focus on this show a lot, almost every day, on the distribution of money and power in the United States, right? And that there are a very, very tiny number of people with incredible wealth and incredible power that attends to that wealth, that results from having that kind of outrageous wealth. And that there's the vast majority of us have very little money in comparative terms and very little power whatsoever. Is that something that just happens naturally? Like, oh, yay, capitalism. Now we see this extraordinary, extreme, greatest that we've ever seen in the history of the country, wealth and income inequality and power asymmetry. Did just that happen? What's going on?
So lots in your question, of course. And the first thing, just in terms of how is this real? It was really interesting. I was having an extended conversation with a former major city police chief. And he actually read a draft of, you know, the manuscript of On Corruption before it came out. And then, you know, and we discussed it at length and he was like, you know, rah, rah and all that. And then at some point he said, but I spent my career working on the kind of crime that really affects people in their everyday lives. Mm-hmm. And I said, wait a second. Okay, so let's just take the crash of 2008, the Great Recession. How many people do you know who were personally affected by that? How many people lost their houses? How many people lost their jobs? How many people committed suicide? How many people got divorced? How many people's savings went up in smoke? I mean, we could go on and on and on, right? Well, that event was caused precisely by the kind of network corruption that I'm talking about. Mm. Because of the role of the financial elites, right? We're talking individuals here, not institutions. We're talking about people who are close to other people. There was this whole deregulation thing. So even though there had been several market crashes starting in the 1980s and lots of really good reforms that were put in place, Bill Clinton came into power and he starts undoing. We all talk about Reagan. Yeah, Reagan started it, but Clinton really did it. And by it being Reagan and then Clinton, you couldn't just say, oh, that deregulation stuff was a kind of radical Republican thing. Let's get rid of it. Now suddenly it became bipartisan orthodoxy. That allowed for what amounts to systemic fraud on Wall Street. That is what caused the meltdown of 2008, systemic fraud on Wall Street. That's called corruption. Now, let's then follow what happened. How many banking executives went to jail?
Zero.
Thank you. Guess why? Because President Obama's attorney general came out of a law firm whose main clientele was major financial institutions and executives. That's what I'm talking about, guys. Yeah. And I don't want to be sounding like I'm wailing on the Democratic Party more than the Republican Party. I'm not. But I come out of, you know, the more sort of Democratic Party ecosystem.
Yes.
And I feel that it is all of our jobs to hold our own communities up to their highest standards. It's too easy to just be pointing the finger across the aisle all the time. Let's hold our own family up to its, you know, principles. So that's the first part of your question. The second part of your question, it has to do with income inequality and the state of the, you know, lived economy in this country. That's the whole objective of corrupt networks, is to reserve economic and political power for network members, to repurpose, retool, bend and twist the instruments of power, the institutions of our government, to serve themselves and their network members at the expense of the ordinary people. So basically, we always think of autocracy as the opposite of democracy. I would almost say kleptocracy is also the opposite of democracy.
I have said on the show that once you reach a certain level of wealth, the only thing you're acquiring is power, political and economic power, because that's the only thing left to acquire. And that at that those levels, that it is no longer Republican or Democratic. It is simply the acquisition of power and wealth for the sake of acquiring more power and wealth, the direct control of both the productive capacity of countries and the wealth that it produces. What's at stake when with this election in November when it comes to corruption? Are both sides equally bad, Sarah?
I wouldn't say equally bad. I wouldn't say equally bad. But I am disappointed that the Democratic Party has not made more of this issue. If the Democratic Party is going to be the party of integrity, of honesty, and of truth, I need to see the anti-corruption program, and I haven't seen it. Now, the Republican Party at the moment is kind of actively, ostentatiously corrupt, right? Like everything is a corrupt bargain. We got that. But I haven't seen much, you know, introspection on the part of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, Sarah, we're actually going to have to leave it there for this half hour, but you are going to email me and every one of you out there that is listening, we're going to get Sarah back on the show ASAP, maybe even this week if we can find some more time, because to me, folks, this is the concern of a generation. And yes, per Sarah, the Republican Party overtly, flagrantly out there corrupt, but we need to demand more of our Democratic elected officials as well. This was fascinating, Sarah. I cannot wait to have you back to talk more about this.
Thanks for listening to Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, a joint production of Civic Media and the Patriotic Millionaires. For more information, go to patrioticmillionaires.org and be sure to tell your friends. The Patriotic Millionaires buy advertising across a number of Civic Media stations.